morning. This is a Triangle Radio reading service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, September the 12th, 2018. We're going to start a little bit differently today. Our major important news item is about Florence, Hurricane Florence. So this information coming from the Weekly Independent came too late to actually be printed in this week's newspaper. This I obtained directly off of the website, but attains updates as to what might be expected. First, dated September 12th at 7:33 a.m., Hurricane Florence expected to turn left, go bother South Carolina instead. The 5 a.m. projections from the National Hurricane Center show Hurricane Florence slowing down and tacking to the south once it nears shore, the result of some sort of steering current, and then lolling its way through South Carolina and into northern Georgia by early Monday morning. If Flo doesn't change her mind again, the Triangle could be spared the worst of it. I saw on the television this morning, this is not me, but the person writing this article, forecast wind speeds in Raleigh hovering in the low 30s, which is significant to be sure, but not catastrophic. We will, however, almost certainly get a ton of rain, probably Matthew amounts, and the concomitant flooding. Provided the storm continues along this path, we can expect somewhere between 5 and 10 inches between Thursday and Monday. This projection from the Weather Channel seems to put us more in the 3 to 5-inch range. And just as a warning, this is information from the Independent that they got from the National Hurricane Center. This is only a look at what is happening as of this morning. For further advances, go to the website and check for yourself. Now, from Tuesday, September 11th, Durham to open two evacuation shelters ahead of Hurricane Florence. This was posted at 5:29 p.m. Ahead of heavy rains and wind brought by Hurricane Florence, Durham will open two evacuation shelters Wednesday for residents who don't feel comfortable staying in their homes. One will open at Bahama Raritan Club, 8202 Stagville Road at noon Wednesday, and the other at Hillside High School, 3727 Fayetteville Road at 6 p.m. Wednesday. In a Tuesday afternoon press conference, Emergency Manager Jim Grove said, "This will be a short-term facilities to house people who evacuate their homes ahead of the storm, which is expected to be felt in the Triangle as early as Thursday." Again, a warning, check out the latest National Weather Service briefings from Raleigh. City and county officials will monitor the severity of the storm and power outages in deciding when and where to open long-term shelters for people displaced by storm damage. This is mainly for folks who do not feel safe in their homes. Maybe a trailer. Maybe rough construction. Maybe you've flooded before and you know there's going to be an issue. These shelters are really just to get folks out of the hazard and give them a safe place to stay as the hurricane goes over us. The two evacuation shelters together can hold upwards of about 600 people. Grove says anyone who uses the evacuation shelters should bring a sleeping bag, pillows, glasses or contacts, medication, and snacks. You can't bring a cooler, alcohol, or drugs. The Bahamas shelter will be pet-friendly. Bring vaccination records for pets, pet carriers, and leashes. Grove said the shelters will be closed if and when sustained wind speeds reach 40 miles per hour or 58 miles per hour gusts. This doesn't mean people will be kicked out, just that the city and the county won't continue to advise people to go out to these locations because it won't be safe for them to be on the roads. At that point, emergency operations will also recommend that fire and police not be dispatched because responding to a call could be dangerous. Grove said, "Residents should be prepared to survive on your own without any assistance for 72 hours. Depending on conditions, emergency responders may not be able to reach people immediately. Please don't depend on us for your safety, Grove said. We will come running, but it's really up to you to be accountable for your own safety. As of Tuesday evening, Durham was expected to see 10 or more inches of rain in the next 7 days, with extreme risks of flash flooding, river flooding, and power outages across central North Carolina. North Carolina is under a state of emergency, and earlier today, the city of Durham and Durham County also signed emergency declarations, allowing shelters to increase their capacities and freeing up the flow of disaster recovery funds. Local shelters are reaching out to homeless individuals in advance of the storm. Urban Ministries of Durham is adding 20 to 30 additional cots on top of the 180 it has now, says Drew Cummings, chief of staff for Durham County. In addition, emergency management will be notifying people living in flood-prone areas beginning tomorrow to seek safety. If your property is flooded in the past, it will now, Grove said. Urge people not to call 911 for general information. Instead, you can call the county helpline at 919-560-HELP. Again, that's 919-560-HELP. Durham One call at 818-560-1200. Again, 818-560-1200. Or better yet, sign up for emergency notifications from Alert Durham. You'll get storm prep information, shelter information, National Weather Service alerts, and recovery information after the storm. For Duke Energy power outages, call 1-800-POWER-ON. 1-800-POWER-ON. For Piedmont Electric Membership Corporation, call 1-800-449-2667. Again, 1-800-449-2667. Or 1-800-222-3107. Again, that's 1-800-222-3107. Grove said the city and the county have identified priority locations in the event of outages, like shelters and hospitals, but plans for restoring power beyond that depend on the utility companies and conditions. Deputy City Manager Bo Ferguson says, "We have no reason to think this event would have any abnormal effect on the water supply. The city water system will continue to work without power," he said. "It's designed to operate in these conditions," Ferguson said. "If water is coming out of your tap during this event, which it should be, the water is safe." Ferguson said water from Durham reservoirs is being released to ensure they can handle heavy rainfall, and in an abundance of caution, those facilities will be monitored by staff. And one other thing, as of yesterday, Wake Durham Chapel Hill schools close ahead of Hurricane Florence. This was posted yesterday at 3:40 p.m. Public schools in Wake and Durham counties will dismiss early Thursday and close Friday in preparation for the havoc Hurricane Florence is expected to wreak when it thrashes the coast Friday morning and works its way inland. Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools will be closed all day Thursday and Friday. Orange County Schools do not yet appear to have been announced when they will close for the storm. The Wake County Public School System announced it would dismiss 2.5 hours early Thursday and close Friday. All after-school activities Thursday and Friday are canceled. Sunday's Wake County College Fair is also canceled. "The safety of our students, parents, and staff remains our top priority," WCPSS said in a statement. "Alerts will be sent out to parents through phone calls, texts, and emails should the schedule change." Durham Public Schools will close 3 hours early Thursday and close Friday. All school-related activities have been suspended through Sunday. CHCCS announced this afternoon that all of its schools would close Thursday and Friday, and all weekend events would be canceled. The district encouraged parents to download its app or follow it on Twitter or Facebook for further updates. NC State has canceled classes beginning noon Wednesday. UNC canceled classes beginning at 5 p.m. Tuesday night, and Duke canceled classes starting at 5 p.m. on Wednesday. Check back for more updates on regional school closings. We return now to the weekly newspaper and the news section. Next year, the Raise the Law, Age Law will move more teenagers into the juvenile justice system. Durham needs to figure out where to put them. At 30 years old, the Durham County Youth Home is in need of some updates. Engineers say that the building itself, a 14-bed facility on Broad Street, is in good condition. It has a new HVAC system and door controls. But it also needs new plumbing, a new roof, and new layout more conducive to separating detainees who are gang-affiliated or have mental or behavioral health issues. And beginning December 1, 2019, when a new law directing 16- and 17-year-olds, previously prosecutors and adults, to the juvenile justice system takes effect, it's going to need more beds. When the Juvenile Justice Reinvestment Act, more commonly called Raise the Age, is implemented, North Carolina will no longer be the only state in the country to prosecute 16- and 17-year-olds as adults. Department of Public Safety officials estimated at least 181 new juvenile beds could be needed across the state to accommodate the change, about double the current number. In Durham last week, there were 14 16- and 17-year-olds being held in the county jail who would be held at least temporarily in the juvenile facility under the new system. There are 291 county cases involving 16- and 17-year-olds who had been affected by Raise the Age in fiscal year 2017, this according to the Administration Office of the Courts. Faced with needed renovations and a growing population, Durham County officials have been looking at building a new 24-bed facility on the current youth home site for about $13 million. But with Raise the Age approaching, they're now weighing whether to build even bigger to help meet demand across the state, or start over completely with a new site and a new approach to juvenile detention. Plans to expand the facility have been delayed since 2000. They really don't have the space to do the kinds of things that are needed to be done to enhance these young folks' lives, says County Commissioner Brenda Howerton. They do a great job with what we have. Well, we don't put any resources into that building. We've got this beautiful jail here for adults. We owe our young people the same consideration. The youth home primarily houses people under 16 who are awaiting trial, but it also serves older teens who have violated previous release conditions. Director Angela Nunn says teenagers come to the youth home, which provides Durham Public School instruction, tutoring, and art programs from all over the state. The average stay last month was about 13 days. Under Raise the Age, criminal cases for all 16- and 17-year-olds, excluded those charged with motor vehicle offenses, will begin in juvenile court. Teens charged with misdemeanors and two lowest classes of felonies will be tried as juveniles and housed in juvenile facilities. 16- and 17-year-olds facing more serious felonies will have their cases transferred to adult court once an indictment or finding of probable cause is made, so it's unclear how long those teens would be held in juvenile detention before their cases are moved. A Juvenile Jurisdiction Advisory Committee, set up by the state, has recommended that anyone under 18 be held in a juvenile facility until their case is adjudicated. But until legislators settle that matter, places like the Durham County Youth Home don't know exactly how much they need to scale up to prepare for the law to take effect. Not only could those teens require beds for longer periods of time while the cases go through the clogged adult courts, they may also require separate accommodations. That is going to be a large group of 16 and 17-year-olds who are accused of more violent or more serious offenses that can't be with the adult population, but also probably will not be with the population tried in juvenile court, says Peggy Nicholson, the co-director of the Youth Justice Project at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. Durham County Jail Director Anthony Prigano told commissioners last week that unless the jail population is greatly reduced, it won't be possible to construct a youth pod in that facility. Nunn says it would be unrealistic to renovate the youth home because the modifications are too expensive for it to remain in use while the work is being done. Instead, she'd like to see a new facility built with additional space to help troubled teens who have not been charged with crimes. In a work session last week, commissioners asked whether the state should contribute to an expansion. County staffers say they have started preliminary conversations with DPS. We need to go into this with the concept that this is a state responsibility, says County Commissioner Ellen Reckow. We need to take the position that we are not building this. We're putting forward a concept that could be done with their support. Last year, legislators set aside $13.2 million for a new youth development center in Rockingham County, the bulk of the state's contribution dedicated to putting Raise the Age into place. That facility, though, isn't expected to open until 2022. In the meantime, DPS officials plan to create a holdover facility by dedicating an additional 30 beds at the C.A. Dillon Youth Development Center in Butner, says spokesman Matt Jenkins. Jenkins says the agency is also working with local leaders to explore additional possibly detention beds throughout the state, but didn't mention Durham. Howerton, inspired by an effort in Scotland County to turn a former prison into a youth center for justice involved teens, suggested that county staffers look and what it would cost to revamp the abandoned state-owned Durham Correctional Center off Guess Road into a youth home equipped with services like job training, life skills, and a garden. If it's just a holding tank, we're not doing anything to give them the tools when they come out to be effective in the community, Howerson said. Our next news article: if Wake County allows Fuquay Barrina to expand its extraterritorial jurisdiction, Jeff Boudin may have to give up his goats. At his home, a few miles outside of Fuquay Barrina in southern Wake County, Jeff Boudin leans over to pet Lily, his golden-haired goat, while his wife and children eat dinner on an enclosed balcony. That little balcony is overlooking a pond carpeted in a rich green algal bloom. Lily, who lives in an electric fence enclosure along with another goat and eight chickens on Burdine's sprawling 8.5-acre property, wags her tail like a dog and nuzzles him. They don't have a mean bone in their body, Burdine said. They will chew your clothes, though. Burdine cares for these animals. More than that, his family uses them for food, eggs for the chicken, hopefully milk and cheese one day from the goats. But he's worried he won't be able to do that for much longer. The government might get in the way. Last month, the town of Fuquay Barrina asked the Wake County Board of Commissioners to expand its extraterritorial jurisdiction, or ETJ, by 22,000 acres. The board isn't expected to take up the request until later this year or next, but if it agrees, Burdine and more than 8,000 county property owners who live outside the town limits could be forced to abide by Fuquay Barrina's stricter zoning rules, including ones regarding animals, even though they won't be able to vote on the town leaders making those rules. And while the town pitches the expanded ETJ as a way to manage growth, It's also not difficult to see it as a way for Fuque Varina to encourage development in certain areas, annex those properties, and then add them to the tax base. On August 28th, the town sent potentially affected property owners a letter summarizing what the ETGA would mean. At first, Bernine skimmed it, not fully understanding the implications. But after a little research, he grew concerned. And then, after more research, angry. Although the ETGA won't come with additional town taxes or services, it would mean myriad new, sometimes obscure, zoning regulations. So Berdine launched a website, stopfuqueetj.org, to sound the alarm, and his neighbors rallied to his banner. A scan of Facebook community groups and the neighborhood site next door shows posts with dozens of comments from residents with no interest in having Fuque Varina's ordinances become the law of the land. I don't think Wake County has a vested interest, Bernine said. Clearly the town is looking to get our tax base. The ETJ would, in essence, allow Fuque Varina to secure property that could eventually be annexed should prospective developers want to link to the town's utility. As County Planner Byron Coates points out, that development is already happening. But whether Fuque Varina gets a say in how it occurs or whether the town benefits from it depends on whether the county grants the ETJ request. The ETJ could also enable Fuque Varina to force developers who are building close to its urban service area or a town water line to agree to annexation, which is technically voluntary, in order to connect to utilities, Coates says, and that will boast the town's tax revenues. One of the fastest-growing communities in the state, Fuque Varina's population doubled between 2000 and 2010, from 7,898 to 17,996, according to town planning director Samantha Smith. In July, the town's population hit 30,000, Smith said, and expected to reach 36,000 by 2020. Effectively quadrupling in two decades. Building permits have also risen, with a record 2,266 new housing lots approved last year and another 1,146 approved through August of this year. Fueling growth in the once rural enclave is the rapacious housing market, with farmers selling acres of land to developers. Driving around the proposed ETJ north of Fuque Varina, where Bernine lives, it's common to see lush tobacco and soybean fields with deteriorating farmhouses that quickly give way to pristine subdivisions which can just as quickly dissolve into dense woods or humble ranches on sprawling parcels. The town's growth is mostly driven by migration, says County Commissioner Matt Calabria. It requires new schools and transit systems, all of which the town needs to pay for. Local governments control growth less than most people think, Calabria said. The key, he says, is smart growth. Calabria said he hasn't decided whether he supports the proposed ETJ, and he won't until he's heard more from residents and county and town staffers. Four residents, including Berdine, have already emailed Calabria in opposition to the ETJ. This growth is good for the Bedroom community, Smith argues, fast, but not in an alarming way. Fuque Varina simply wants to have some control over how it occurs, Smith said, and that's where the ETJ comes in. The ETJ provides transition area between the town limits and the county, Smith said. The reason we're interested in doing this expansion is because it's no secret that Wake County is growing, and we're interested in growing in the most responsible and well-managed way possible. We believe that our expanding, our ETJ, accomplishes that. Folks are selling their property for development, whether or not it's in a town or county's jurisdiction. So the town asked Wake County to increase its ETJ by 22,049 acres, up from its current 8,739 acres. Per state law, Municipalities with more than 25,000 residents can't extend their ETJs up to 3 miles from their town limits, according to the letter sent to residents. For the town, this ETJ will ensure that new developments come with an infrastructure improvements and contribute to the transportation network, which can help alleviate traffic congestion, Smith said. For residents, at least with those with no big development plans, Smith says, it won't make much of a difference. Burdine doesn't buy it. He points to a list of ordinances on the town website, including one whose language he deems less than clear. I've read this 1,000 times, and I still don't know whether I'm allowed to have goats or not, Burdine says. He wouldn't be. Under Fuquay Varina's existing regulations, non-domestic animals such as goats are only allowed on bona fide farms, and Burdine's property isn't considered such a farm. Chickens along with horses and pigs are permitted with regulations, Smith said. Burdine's problem isn't the number of goats and chickens he can keep on his wooden property. It's the fact that when he built his dream home on Hilltop Needmore Road 3 years ago, he didn't think he'd have to comb through dense municipal code to find out what he could do and couldn't do. My issue was around my land and the fact that I'm never going to sell. Yet I'm still being forced to live by Fuquay Varina rules, he said. That's just not right. Even if I could get myself to think that was right, the fact that I can't vote makes it, to me, not the American way. The only people I vote for is the county. And once the county gives that away, I have no say in what ordinances they pass. Smith says she understands Burdine's frustration. The town is working to retool its ordinances to accomplish people in the proposed ETJ and animal regulations are on the list. Wake County zoning is a little bit looser on things like non-domestic animals than our regulations are, and we know that, she said. County commissioners broached the subject of future development in Fuquay Varina last week while approving a request from Fuquay Varina to reclassify 7,581 acres of its urban service area along the eastern portion of the ETJ from long to short range, a bureaucratic-sounding distinction that signals a significant investment in municipal utilities in that area, one of the least developed near Fuquay Varina, within 10 years. Down the road from Burdine's house, the rural town has already annexed and approved a 185-home subdivision across 77 acres of former farmland. The developer is clearing the land with large tractors, moving dirt and leaving twisted tree roots upended like fallen soldiers across the property. It's sad, but good for them, Burdine says. I don't cover them then well. I don't even rather go there. Burdine doesn't pretend he can stop the area from changing, nor, he says, does he want to. He hopes he can help galvanize opposition to the ETJ by educating residents on what it will mean. Burdine thinks if he can rally a few hundred people to come out to the Wake County Board of Commissioners when it debates the matter, they might stand a chance at avoiding Fuquay Varina's zoning laws. But development, even in Wake's most rural corners, is something that won't be avoided. We're seeing growth swoop south, Calabria said. The town and the county and others are attempting to be prepared for it. The area and the proposed ETJ is going to see a lot of growth, and that's regardless of any decisions that local government will make. It's coming. We turn now to the Fall Arts and Culture Guide. Before the flood, batten down the hatches. Fall is here. Well, folks, we're starting the fall season with quite a bang this year, aren't we? As the Indy's 2018 Fall Arts and Culture Guide was hurling toward the printer, Hurricane Florence started hurling toward the Triangle. We've noticed confirmed cancellations and postponements whenever possible. But be sure to call ahead or look online to confirm anything we've listed for the coming week to make sure it's still happening. As we know, more cancellations will be coming down the pike after press time. One thing that we know for sure is not happening, at least not this weekend, It's a, excuse me, the debut of D. Cole's Dreamville Festival at Raleigh's Dix Park, which, of course, we made the anchor story of the music section of our fall guide. But given the resources behind and the excitement around the festival, we think there's a good chance it will get rescheduled. So we hope you enjoy reading about what might have been and what may yet come to be. But luckily, most of our fall guide centers on developments in local arts and culture that are ongoing or further out. In the world of food, we take a look at the latest culinary trends storming the triangle, the food court, the food hall. In visual art, we celebrate the bold new vision driving UNC Chapel Hill's sometimes neglected Acklin Art Museum into the future during its 60th anniversary season. In the performing arts, we wonder if the most viable newcomer to help the fruit fill the Durham presenting void left by the closures of Common Ground and Man Bites Dog Theater might be Northgate Mall. In literary spheres, we have an intimate conversation with new NC poet laureate Jackie Shelton Green about her drive to amplify muted voices. And on screen, we delve into two film festivals, an old one at UNC and a new one at Duke, which fill missing links to black independent film. All of these stories are about new institutions and changes in old ones that will affect your experience of Triangle arts and culture for the better this autumn and hopefully in years to come. But of course, if you're just looking for a great show, we have editor's picks in each section highlighting our can't-miss tickets of the season. Oh, hi, Hamilton. We'll see you in the halls and nightclubs, the food halls and bookstores, the museums and theaters, provided we don't all get blown away. Now, has anybody seen my ruby slippers? Follow the bouncing ball. With a fresh public-facing vision, a slate of exciting 60th anniversary exhibits, and an impending interior remodel, the Acklin Art Museum bounds into the future. That's a museum with a dead guy in it, right? This is what my daughter says when I tell her we're going to an exhibit at the Acklin Art Museum at UNC Chapel Hill. And it's true. As a part of his bequest, William Hayes Acklin lies in state in an alcove crypt off a narrow galley. But he's the only dead thing about the Acklin, an institution that is taking the occasion of its 60th anniversary this fall to re-energize its spaces and tap, recommit to campus and community, and maybe even kickstart the process of getting new building that fits its current work and ambitious future. Under the leadership of director Katie Ziegler, who came on 2 years ago, the Acklin has reconsidered every aspect of its operations, collections, exhibitions, programming, and especially how it uses its modest space. The anniversary celebrations kick off this week with a surprise-laden exhibition of new acquisitions, an artist residency by Lonnie Holly, the Red Ball Public Art Project, and the relaunch of Arts And, a hybrid community and exhibition space. Add this to a top-to-bottom refreshing of the Acklin's permanent collection and a flurry of new community partnerships, and it expresses the organizational values that come out of the museum's deep reconsideration, rigor, responsiveness, and playfulness. We're getting ready to burst forward, Ziegler says. I felt coming in that our connections with the local community didn't equal what we have with the university by a long shot. So I really wanted to see us improve in that direction. The first thing Ziegler did when she arrived was to create the Terrence Gallery, the previously austere outdoor space along the street frontage of the museum. She brought in Los Trompas, an interactive installation of huge, colorful tops by contemporary Mexican designers Hector Suarez and Ignacio Cadena. Students and visitors could climb and spin on whatever were essentially giant toys laced with fabric woven in traditional style by Mexican artisans, making the Acklin's front yard into a play space nonetheless charged by art. The terrace is now showing North Carolina artist Patrick Doherty's Step Right Up, 5 stickwork sculptures big enough to get inside, which were inspired by the ancient pouring vessel in the Acklands collection. Ziegler's goal of more outward-facing Acklands continues with the Red Ball Project, which kicks off with a celebration on Thursday, September 20th at 1:30 p.m. Part Instagram age, public art piece, part scavenger hunt. It consists of a giant red ball that changes location throughout a city each day. The brainchild of artist Kurt Preschke, Red Ball has traveled to more than 25 cities across the world. On top of recent partnership with Flash Chorus, Earspace Ensemble, and the Film Forum series on women directors at the Varsity Theater, it marks the Acklands as a champion of community involvement. While transforming outdoor spaces into galleries, the Acklands is also changing one of its galleries back into a multi-use community space, Arts And, a flex room that can be lounge, programming, or exhibition space, returns on September 21st with commission work of Bespoke Wallpaper by Baltimore-based artist and UNC alum Lauren Francis Adams. Arts And will feature artist talks, performances, art-making classes, and film screenings while remaining open to spontaneous meetings and just hanging out. Adams' work is timely for UNC and Chapel Hill regarding the toppling of the Silent Sam Confederate statue and the legal proceedings of the activist who toppled it. She ornately juxtaposes racially charged historic imagery. One work combines Google Street View locations in Baltimore, where formerly enslaved people lived, with a wallpaper pattern from President Andrew Jackson's home showing how, for many Americans, racial inequality remains an easily ignored background fact in their daily lives. Durham-based artist Stacey L. Kirby follows Adam with an Art And installation planned for spring. The Acklands also opens the exhibition Birthday Presents on September 21st, bringing together 60 recent acquisitions from more than 30 donors. The show offers a look at the museum's broad collecting perspective, as well as its emphasis on African and post-war work. It includes Rembrandt etchings, drawings, and prints by Stuart Davis, Lionel Feininger, Lee Krasner, Jasper Johns, and Adolf Gottlieb, and video and film work, including former art department faculty member Jeff Whetstone's The Batcher Ritual, which showed at Prospect New Orleans last year. Typically, when people think of visionary or vernacular work, it's by artists from the American South. Working with the American Studies Department, the Acklands is challenged in the narrowness of these definitions as well as its own collections. Assistant curator Lauren Turner highlights a trio of drawings by Inuit artists, all women, as an indicator of Auckland's broadened view toward collecting. In many ways, these artists meet the definition of vernacular, but not in ways that you'd expect, Turner says. There are things you need to be redressed from years of collecting patterns. This new thinking won't simply be highlighted in a temporary exhibition for an anniversary year. It will also transform the Acklands' permanent exhibition space later in the fall. Walls will be relocated and painting more colorfully. A gallery will be devoted to post-war and contemporary art, shrinking the space for the art of the ancient Mediterranean. Much more of the rich collection of works on paper will be on display, with creative solutions for the light exposure risks, as well as work from throughout the African continent, both classical and contemporary. Peter Nisbet, Deputy Director for Curatorial Affairs, is excited to show some of the museum's vernacular photography collection, consisting of about 40 anonymous works of everyday snapshot photography from around 1900 until the present. There are some amazing images that come up when you look at the vernacular photography in a way that's challenging and inspiring and irritating all at once, because often the aesthetic power of these works comes about by chance, Nismet said. A photograph taken with a finger partly across the lens ends up being a really interesting composition. Or somebody diving into a pool, caught at just the right moment, can exhibit extraordinary transcendental grace. And did you know that the Ackland has a second floor? The museum is rebranding its upstairs study gallery, where it presents 12 small exhibits per semester in conjunction with UNC classes, as Ackland upstairs, after realizing that the public, assuming the space was off-limits to non-students, almost never climbed the stairs. Elizabeth Manikin, head of university programs and academic projects, has rethought how to make the small shows more engaging for non-academic visitors, offering framed questions with the class syllabi. You might not be in a survey course of 19th century Romanticism, Turner says, but you can use this to say, hey, where do you see the sublime in your life? With all these changes inside and outside the galleries, the Ackland has also expanded its staff, bringing on Dana Cowan as the new Sheldon Peck Curator for European and American Art before 1950, a specialist in prints, photographs, and drawings, which make up about two-thirds of the Ackland's collection. Cowan's hire is supported by an $8 million endowment from Peck and his wife Lena, and will be focused partially on their gift of primarily 17th-century European masterworks, valued at $17 million. Dana is really committed to working with classes and teaching and research and adopting new technology into exhibition spaces, Turner said. She's going to be very good for us, considering how one of our biggest challenges is that we don't have that many galleries to do exhibitions. If getting the most out of its space seems to be an obsession at the Ackland, it's because the museum outgrew it long ago. But the Triangle has been seeing the openings at the National Museum of Art at Duke in 2005, the New World North Carolina Museum Art's gigantic West Building in 2010, the relocation and expanse of NC State's Gregg Museum of Art and Design in 2017, and Duke's launch of the Rubenstein Art Center this year. The Ackland has plugged along in its brick box sandwich between the Haynes Art Center and some retail buildings. When Katie Ziegler arrived, she made no bones about it, has been said. She has talked about a new building tirelessly, trying to work out with the university how best to do it. She is unshakable in this argument. We've outgrown our current building any way you want to measure it, from exhibition space to storage and office space, Ziegler said. And we're lacking a lot of amenities that a lot of museums these days have for their visitors. A cafe, an auditorium. We also don't have classrooms for many students who come to look at art during their courses. During the potential of many events at this birthday year, as a proof of concept for a new building, Ziegler is also, is also mindful of how slowly such projects move forward or stall out. This time, we plan to do it in such a way that it will succeed. In the meantime, we have a lot of work to do to get to that point, Ziegler said. Maximizing what we can do inside the building is one step, as is pushing outside to the terrace. We kept doing interactive art out there, so in a way, we're open even when we're not open. Ziegler seems to be changing the idea of a new building from an if to a when. In the meantime, the re-energized Ackland is offering plenty of reasons to visit the art museum with the dead guy in it throughout this fall. Now the stage section. Stage whispers. With Man Bites Dog gone, the future of Durham Theater might reside at, wait, really? Northgate Mall? Little About Theater number 10 at Durham's Northgate Mall suggests that it could be a game changer for live performance in the region. The reddish-brown decor, muted runway lights, and 214 plush rocking seats are typical of a modern movie theater. As the house lights dim and the trailers roll, you might not notice the two modest banks of theatrical LED lights nested beyond the last pair of speakers on the walls, or the unobtrusive gray dais standing 18 inches off the floor beneath the screen. But when Bartlett Theater opens its season with The Flick in this room on November 2nd, both will be unmistakable. In many ways, it's the perfect venue for Annie Baker's 2014 Pulitzer-winning drama, which is set in a movie theater, undergoing changes in ownership and projection technology. Those shifts influence the relationship and fates of what the Pulitzer community called lives rarely seen on stage. Those of three dissatisfied young adults working jobs at subsistence wages. But in this case, placing a play about a cinema in a cinema isn't just another experiment in immersive, site-specific theater, an emerging genre of choice among the area's younger thespians. It's also the first trial of an ongoing project to transform this section of Northgate Mall into a regional destination for the performing arts. As it happens, this project is but one of several initiatives to roll out over the coming year, designed to address a dilemma that has bedeviled regional staying artists for decades, an acute lack of space, both suitable and affordable, to make and present their work. Across town, The Understudy, a project set in the foundation of the tower at Mutual Plaza, Carl and Clancetti Webb's redevelopment of the UNC Mutual Insurance Building, they will provide studio, shop, and storage space for dance, theater, music, and video artists. Meanwhile, the American Dance Festival recently announced a new subsidy program that will provide choreographers across access to its rehearsal studios at $10 per hour, a 75% discount from its professional rate. All of these majors follow the closures in recent years of venues such as Chapel Hill's Deep Dish Theater and Durham's Common Ground and Man Bites Dog Theater, which has set cash-strapped artists scrambling for affordable alternatives. The Fruit, Tim Walters' multi-purpose, multi-genial art space and creative playground in Durham, has picked up some of the slack, hosting recent productions by the Women's Theater Festival, Little Green Pig Theatrical Concern, DIDA-affiliated artists, and Snap P Underground's groundbreaking The Banquet. But the need for space, for performance, rehearsal, set fabrication, storage, and offices among small and emerging performing arts groups clearly outstrips any single initiative or venue. The Northgate plan involves transforming several of the Stadium 10 theaters and an adjacent storefront into venues suitable for a spectrum of live performances, including theater, dance, and music. For the mall, the emphasis is to redevelop it at a time when Credit Suisse predicts that a quarter of all U.S. malls will close by 2022. Most regional malls are struggling, says Virginia Bowman, Northgate's managing general partner. Retail is shrinking, so we have to look at better uses of our facilities. We all have to change, explore, and try new things. And now to food. All you can eat. The food halls are coming. The food halls are coming. But what makes them different than food courts? On a Wednesday at 11 a.m., I faced down my toughest decision of the day. What to eat for lunch? I pored over menus as I wandered, debating between butter chicken from Curry in a Hurry or pork chimichurri expandes from Mecas Empanadas before settling on lotus root salad and summer rolls from MKG Kitchen. While I waited for my food at the communal table, a young couple sitting nearby made me wonder if I should have ordered a cow bar burger, while two gentlemen incited a case of order envy, slurping bowls of the broth ramen from their perches and overstuffed chairs. I can't think of many restaurants where diners can choose from dozens of different cuisines spanning every meal and satisfying nearly every craving. Or one where it'd be acceptable to change tables mid-meal, or one that served high-quality local food in minutes, all without having to reserve a table. At the newly opened Morgan Street Food Hall in Raleigh's Warehouse District, this dining utopia is a reality. And by early 2019, the Triangle will be home to four food halls, each with its own look, vibe, and vendor mix. But what makes food halls different from food courts? Whereas a food court is an amenity, a place to grab a bite while shopping, food halls are a destination. All four Triangle food halls put a premium on local businesses, giving many chefs a chance to open their first brick and mortar or bring niche offerings to the wider audience. Food halls also curate ambience, incorporating greenery, local artwork, lighting, custom acoustics, and comfortable seating. Oh, and did we mention? There's also booze. This means that we are going to eat and drink very well in the coming months. But the food hall boom also has the potential to satisfy our hunger for connection. Connection to our food, to our small business community, and to one another. I think we're seeing a cultural shift in the way people think about social interactions, says developer Jason Queen. People are embracing the need for social interactions, and I think that's a hell of an opportunity for food halls to do that, and to do it well. Queen is the founder of Transfer Company Food Hall, slated to open early 2019 in the historic Carolina Coach Garage and Shop and former home of the Transfer Company bus line in Raleigh's Old East End neighborhood. Besides sitting across the table from someone you might not otherwise share a meal with, Queen says that at the Transfer Company, social interaction is built into the food offering. Because each vendor's production space is open, diners have the chance to say, watch oysters being shucked at local's oyster bar, or a bar of chocolate being made at Videri Chocolate Factory. This also sates curious foodies yearn to know more about their food, and millennials' desire for food to provide an experience. Social connection can also extend to vendors. Queen envisions Best Warmers Bagels, a collaboration between Jabala Coffee and Bolded Bread, offering a bagel top with smoked fish from locals' Seafoods Rest Market, or perhaps having Burial Beer Company collaborate with Videri Chocolate on a food hall exclusive chocolate stout. These unique one-offs help make food halls destination worthy and keeps diners coming back. Durham Food Hall founder Adair Mueller agrees that fostering collaboration and creativity is key for chefs, too. A food hall is like a playground to a chef. In a full-service restaurant or even a food truck, they're so limited. There are a lot of constraints, so you have to be quite as creative. You can't be as creative and constantly changing and maintaining a new menu, Mueller said. I love that aspect in that they can truly create. And if an item isn't working and it flops, you can change it. You haven't invested that same cost. Mueller also sees Durham Food Hall, slated to open early thunder 2018, as an incubator for food entrepreneurs. Housed in the former Liberty Warehouse, the Durham Food Hall boasts 15,000 square feet, so it could easily accommodate more than 10 vendors. And with 250 applications, there was plenty of interest. But Mueller was intentional about finding the right mix. In addition to a high-quality offering, she chose vendors with interesting stories, unique products, and ones with shared values for sustainability and local sourcing. There's Lula and Sadie's, a multi-generational family endeavor focused on seasonal southern staples with a modern twist. Think Eggnog Pecan French Toast. Couples own businesses such as Afters, specializing in cake and dessert flights. And women-owned businesses such as Ex-Photo Kachina Nixtamal, which uses heirloom corn to make masa and tortillas for its tacos and tamales. These businesses also a focus for Blue Dogwood Public Market in Chapel Hill, the Triangle's first food hall, which opened in mid-June. Food halls are a way for small businesses to get started with less investment. And they can test new concepts with less risk. At Blue Dog Dogwood, you'll find gluten-free baked goods at Pizzelle Bakery, peanut-free chocolates at Chocolatey Confections, vegan tacos and wraps at Vegan Flava, and plant-based tamales and arepas at Sol Cucina. Blue Dogwood lives up to the public market part of its moniker, too. In addition to picking up a sandwich from the whole animal butcher, Left Bank Butchery, you can also buy fresh sausages, steaks, and cocatura to take home, along with cheeses from Chapel Hill Creamery and bread from Pittsburgh Chicken Bread Bridge Bakery. Blue Dogwood will soon add a produce vendor, making it one of the few places to buy fresh produce in downtown Chapel Hill. But before you head home from your bounty, if you feel like lingering, you can, because there are no table vultures hovering with a reservation. Head over to Blue Dogwood's bar and order an afternoon brew. It's the easiest decision you'll have to make all day. Before we sign off for today, one last change affected by Florence coming from the website of The Independent. Thanks for nothing, Florence. The Durham Bulls will play all five games of the Governor's Cup on the road. Tonight, the Durham Bulls will take to Scranton's PNC Field for Game 1 of the Governor's Cup Finals against Scranton-Wilkesboro. The winner of the best-of-five series, the first two games of which were to be played in Scranton, the rest in Durham, will claim the title of champion of the International League, one of the two AAA leagues. All five games, the Bulls announced this afternoon, will be played in Scranton, a city best known as the birthplace of Joe Biden and the home of the Dunder Mifflin Paper Company. We're obviously disappointed in losing up to three games of our home field, especially for a championship series, Durham Vice President Mike Burley said in a statement. However, nothing is more important to us than the safety of our fans, our players, coaches, and staff. Working with the International League offices and Rail Raiders staff, we found an option that keeps all parties safe. We thank everyone for their hard work in the last few days in finding a solution. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.